You can't humiliate me or embarrass me about something that I am taking back the ownership of. People control me and I'm like, I know what I look like. My job is not to be beautiful for you.
My next guest does not need a formal introduction because you're all going to know her. It's Katie Piper, OBE. I know so many of you would have followed Katie's journey, as I have, for years and admired her. And I suppose there's just this huge list, isn't there, of what you would say when you think about Katie Piper. So resilience and grit and courage. And literally, it's by the bucket loads, this conversation. I enjoyed it so very much. But speaking to her one-to-one, it gave me something surprising, which is the radiance of the human spirit and how she carries it so effortlessly. And you know that that would have taken nearly two decades to get to that point. One of the other things that struck me was the lesson that kept coming through our conversation, that no matter what we go through, and obviously Katie talks about her horrific attack, but actually the scars that many women or people have, visible or hidden, that they don't have to define us and that they can be the very spark of hope and courage and new life if we channel the right energy around it. So this is definitely a conversation that's going to shift the way that you see life, you know, because Katie's perspective can't help but make you reflect, feel full of gratitude, and maybe face the challenges we have in our own lives with completely new lenses. So soak it all up, everyone, and enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Katie, I'm thrilled to be speaking to you today. We've got our tea. We've had our comfort break. We were like women in a hurry to start the podcast, and then we needed to get the firm things out the way so that we could enjoy this conversation. Yeah. Welcome to Conversations of Inspiration.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. As I haven't been, sometimes I dread or get nervous about things, and this I've just been really looking forward to. So,
oh, that's really nice to hear. I've been so looking forward to this as well. You're a woman that just embodies resilience and empowerment and positivity. And I suppose that's why I've been so looking forward to talking to you, because it's a real honour. How have you been? Am I right in thinking that you've just recently turned 42?
Yes. Yeah.
How did you celebrate?
Oh, it was really nice, actually. I'd been, I'm sure you'll relate to this, you know, when you work for yourself, when you're self-employed, sometimes things get so busy and you couldn't even have sort of foreseen that happening. And I just had this kind of solid 6-7 months like that. And in that time, my eldest had started secondary school and she really needed me. And I'd felt so pulled in so many different directions. And my husband was like, what do you want to do? What do you want to do for your birthday? And in my head, I was thinking, go to bed, go to bed, wear no makeup. You know, that's probably about it. And we sort of did just that. We went to the Cotswolds, out to countryside. We took the kids, we took the dog, and we were just in a cottage. We were in pajamas. We went out cycling. We ate, we drank, and we had like three whole days, three nights of that.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, watch telly. We did. Oh, we like a lot of like games. We like Dobble, Connect Four, Happy Families. Very 90s of us, actually.
Yeah, very nostalgic, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
And it's like, I love that.
I didn't want to just go away with my husband because it's like I don't get to see the kids as much as I want to because of work. So I wanted to share it with them. And sometimes all the logistics of getting someone to have the dog, have the kids is more stressful, you know?
Absolutely. Well, the logistics, it's, don't you find it's, the logistics to sort of sort the logistics.
Oh, and look, I'm not, I love my husband, he's brilliant, but let's face it, all the logistics are going to be down to me. And in the end, it's not an enjoyable birthday.
I know. I call it light logistics and heavy logistics.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's like this little mix that you do. Certainly then just to even get away for your own birthday.
Uh-huh.
Hence why you're like, can I just actually just skip the whole thing and just go to bed? Because actually, if you want to give me the gift, the logistics for you to then think I'm having a lovely time. I'm sure you had a lovely time, but you know what I mean? That pressure.
It's the pressure. And then you feel so terrible because especially if someone else has organized it for you.
Yeah.
And this sounds so ungrateful. On Wednesday, I've been married 10 years and my husband's like, I've arranged for us to go away. And I'm like, oh no.
Oh my God, we've just been away. Hang on a minute.
Leave me alone. Yeah, I need to be grateful again. I haven't got it in me.
I love that. Oh my goodness. Well, we're talking such truth and we haven't even started. I want to go back, if I can, we do on this podcast, before we get into so much and so many things that you framed so eloquently in your book, Still Beautiful, which we're going to talk about. But before we get into that, I wondered if we could take you to another age, not 42, slightly younger, to the little Katie growing up in Hampshire with your parents, David and Diane, and your brother Paul and sister Susie. And your father was a barber and yeah. Your mum was a teacher. And I read that when researching you, that it was a really happy childhood and it was a close-knit community. And I laughed when I read that because your dad was the local barber and your mum the teacher, and all the children either had a haircut from your dad yeah. or a detention from your mum.
Yeah,
I love this.
And my mum was a very dedicated mother, so she sacrificed her career. Once she had three kids, she then did supply teaching. So it even happened that sometimes when our teacher was off sick, my mum came in as the supply teacher for us. So yeah, it was a really small community which had more sort of positives than negatives. But yeah, everyone knew mum and dad. Everyone knew us. And, you know, it was very of its time where we were out all weekend on our bikes, roller skating.
I heard you were a bit of a tomboy.
A real tomboy. And I think that's kind of country living, not growing up in the city, that you're outdoors loads. Phones didn't exist. Internet didn't exist. And you just said you'd be back by dinner time. And you were, you know. And
I
look back on it now and you don't realise it when you're in it, but it was an idyllic childhood. You know, we weren't wealthy. We went to state school. We didn't travel abroad every year. We walked to school because there was one car and mum and dad shared it. But actually, I think that was quite a normal life back then. And we didn't have social media where everyone could share or show off. And, you know, I was really happy. I grew up just like all my friends. And like, maybe even now, it would be seen as we were sort of poor. But actually, it didn't really feel like that, you know.
As you said, it's just a completely different moment. We were just chatting before coming onto the podcast about we're sounding really quite old, the youth of today. Not really the youth, we're just talking about how definitely we weren't buying lip glosses in sort of high street Space NKs or anything yeah. like that. And it's all changed. I mean, I think when you talk about growing up and being that sort of tomboy and out and about, I find it interesting when I hear about where people come from, you can sort of see it in their later life. Do you think that that's where now your sort of your spirit comes from, being sort of a free and within your own imagination?
Yeah, I think so. And I think you're right. It's only when you sort of look back with hindsight, you can understand that. And I think, you know, growing up with an older brother, I was definitely more tomboy. He did karate, I did judo. We ran about in the mud together. My mum was a big influence on me. She was very strong but silent, quite stoic, quite British, quite stiff upper lip, which, you know, meant we didn't always talk about our feelings, but she was always there for me. Like it was a stable, consistent love where I knew if I needed her, I could call on her. And that felt really important for me. And I think with my dad, he was always working, but he was present, you know, like he would do housework. He would get on his knees and pretend to be a dinosaur. Like he showed up in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
He didn't just disappear and say, I'm the breadwinner and that's what I do and that's it. But I would remember him coming home, beans on toast, quick walk the dog and go back out to them work in the evening to do evening haircuts and then come home, go to bed, then go do Saturdays as well. So
gosh,
he was always working and we didn't have a lot of money, but they made the best of everything. Like we would go to Kent and go on holiday. And then when we finally went abroad, we'd go with another family on a package holiday to Spain. If we couldn't get somewhere because the car was broken, we'd all walk together or get the bus. So they kind of instilled into me quite early on that you can have anything you want within reason, but you have to input, you have to work, you have to keep going, you have to find another route. And I think they gave me that kind of almost like an excitement, you know, of like, wow, lots of things are possible if I really work at it. And also living in the countryside, like you would use your imagination. We'd go out and sit in like farmers' fields, sit in the hay bale, the big sheds, and we would all like tell each other stories, talk about things. And it made me excited for what's out there and could it be mine? And maybe for my parents, it gave me too much curiosity and too much excitement.
I was going to say, you possibly could have been a nightmare teenager.
Yeah.
And so I love this. Potentially a little bit too much curiosity is putting it nicely. Do you think you're being hard on yourself because you're now a mum and you look back? I mean, I've apologised quite frequently to my mum over the years, just sort of going back and thinking, if my son behaved in that way, I don't know what I would do. And he hasn't. And I always make out, by the way, that was completely perfect. And it's so funny when my mum then says, what did your mother say that she did? let me rewrite that story. Yeah. Are you being hard on yourself or do you think you were?
I think I've had it in confirmation from my parents that I was an absolute hellraiser. And it's so funny because, Joe, that saying about you get the child you deserve.
Yeah.
And I kind of get the impression from my mum now that she herself had that streak. So maybe not as bad as me, but, okay. You know, she was from London. She left and moved to Hampshire. I know she used to smoke as well. And, you know, she sounds a bit more like the younger me. But I really hope I don't get the child that I deserve in my kids. and it's funny because yesterday Belle went to the shop on her own for the first time, like with a friend, but without an adult for the first time yesterday. And I sat there thinking, oh my God, and looking out the window. And I thought, no, if this was younger me, I'd be smoking cigarettes by now, you know? So I'm lucky. And I did do that thing when I gave birth to my first child. I did ring my mum and I was like, okay, sorry about everything, because now I realise what a responsibility it is and what an unconditional love it is and how it makes you feel slightly vomity if anything bad happens.
Yes.
So I do feel bad on them. And I do think, you know, it was a mixture of like wanting to go out into the world and conquer it and see what was out there. But I did have a fairly strict upbringing that I think almost glamorized what might be out there and what I wasn't allowed to access. And I think for my parents, they had it difficult because my brother, he's really successful. He's really intelligent, really academic, and almost quite introvert. And he wasn't particularly social. He didn't have girlfriends till much later in life. So I think they had him and thought that that was a teenager. And then they met me and they were like, oh, that's not the teenager we've already experienced. So
they had it easy before meeting you.
Yeah. But it's funny because, you know, it all comes full circle. And now I would call my mum my friend and I choose her and I love spending time with her and I understand her. And I hope that she understands me too as well. It hasn't had a detrimental effect on our relationship in the long run.
I want to touch on after leaving school because you trained as a beautician. But how did you find actual school?
Well, my mum was brilliant when it came to education because she would help us so much outside of school with reading and writing. And she spent so much time, you know, when you talk about motherhood, it's absolutely a full-time job, you know, and she sat there and did all that work with us so that we were, you know, really clever. We were quite curious and I loved reading as a hobby, you know, not just for school, and English and English Lit was my favourite. But I think by the time I was in the second year of secondary school, I also loved boys.
Yeah.
Smoking, socialising, drinking, you know, and I just think actually I really got distracted by that. And sometimes I suppose that's been some of the stuff that I've talked through in therapy is some of my regrets of what could I have done if I'd have pushed myself academically, you know, what sort of job would I have done if I hadn't sought so much external validation and prioritised all those other relationships rather than the relationship with myself.
But my goodness me.
It's quite deep,
that's
right?
Deep. That is deep. I mean, wouldn't we all say that though as well? Isn't that hindsight?
I think it is because I know later on you talk about, you know, letter to your younger self.
Yeah.
And I almost think my younger self wouldn't have even opened the envelope. She would have been like, go away, old woman.
Complete. And also, I know it. Why do I need to hear from anyone else? I'm completely in control here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's, I totally agree. You left school and you trained as a beautician before moving to London in your 20s to follow your dreams of modelling and presenting. That must have been a very exciting time because you're this curious, you feel a little bit, I'm slightly similar. I was in a hurry. Let's
yeah.
just put it that way.
Oh, yeah.
I was desperate to get out there.
Yeah.
And I started, those listening know, I started work at 17 in advertising.
Uh-huh.
And I do you know what I mean? Couldn't get a phone fast enough, couldn't get money fast enough, just wanted uh-huh. wanted it all and I wanted it now. So moved out of home so young. So I think we were both in a hurry and you were young and you were in the new city and everything ahead. But a few years later in 2008, just as you were beginning to taste success, the unthinkable happened. And I know you've spoken about this many times and we're going to just talk because there's so much to talk about outside of this event. But something happened to you that changed everything and you had a horrific experience, an attack with acid. And I know you've spoken about it many times, but just to give context to your life and just as, to move us through, would you mind sharing this part of the story with us today?
So how I got from sort of Hampshire to London to all that happening to me was I got work as a beautician. And the beauty industry was very different back then. You're talking like 2001, right?
You were about 24, were you?
I was 17 when I left home.
Yep.
And then by the time I left college, I was sort of 19.
Yep.
And I'd got this job in a salon and it was very sales-led, right? So you had to sell product and you had to sell block courses of treatment. So looking back on it now...
Oh, yes, block courses.
Yeah, it was actually not a lot of beauty and loads of sales. It was
yes.
a sales job, right? And I ended up, and it was all my clients were women, and I ended up making really good friends with clients, like amazing, like I realize it now, but I didn't then. Like that was my intro into like sisterhood and how brilliant women can be. And I met all these different types. And when you're a beautician, people tell you about their marriages, their affairs, their jobs, their mental health, their depression. And I got close to all these women and I got really good at sales, right? And I was making good money and I realized I kind of almost had the gift of the gab and I enjoyed not having the same like salary every month and how could I increase it and what could I do here? What could I do there? And then I decided I should just go it alone and set up my own business. So I just got a wax pot and a foldable couch from Sally's and I had a little 4KA and I was going to like random places. I was going to like the upstairs of the pub to do the landlady's lip chin and eyebrow wax.
Yeah.
And I was working till midnight because some women wanted massage and pedicures at 11 at night when they were finishing work and putting the kids to bed. And I was earning all this cash and hand money and it was great. And then I had this boyfriend at the time and he just finished his uni course and he was from London. And he was like, come to London with me. I don't want to break up with you. And I'd seen so many films and read all these books because I had this big imagination. I'd read all these romance books and I was like, he's in love with me and I love him and this is forever. So I followed him and left behind my new small business that was doing so well, all my clients, prioritized a guy instead of what I was doing back there. And I moved to London. And for whatever reason, it didn't work out in the long term with me and him. And I couldn't afford to live in London. I'd been naive coming from Hampshire about how expensive it was. And he'd been the one paying for where we were living. So I found a shared house. And in the shared, we turned the lounge into a bedroom, five shared bedrooms. And everyone was an aspiring actress, dancer, model, West End star. But nobody had quite made it. They were all going to auditions. And I thought, I could do this, you know, like I feel like I'm blonde, I'm loud, I sold all those products in that salon, I can
yeah.
work on the shopping channel. And that's what I started doing. I started working on the shopping channel. I mean, when I say I was a model, you know, I'm 5'3", so I wasn't quite Claudia Schiffer. It was kind of more head and shoulders at that point. But you know what? It was one of those lives where I probably earned about 300-400 quid a month. Back then, the room rent would have been 170 quid a month.
Yeah.
We barely ate and we just bought like all the reduced food at midnight in Sainsbury's.
Yes.
We all shared clothes to go clubbing. We didn't have social media. We didn't need to wear clothes once,
yeah.
you know. And it was a life that revolved around my levels of confidence, self-esteem, and the way that I looked. So I assume that's why when somebody wanted to hurt me, in fact, destroy me, the approach that they chose was to throw sulfuric acid into my face. And this happened to me after I'd been dating a guy for probably no more than 2 or 3 weeks, right? And when you're dating somebody over 2 or 3 weeks, you're not seeing each other every day because I had to work and do other things. But I saw him a handful of times, and it was enough times to know, actually, we weren't really the same type of people. We weren't right for each other. And I didn't want to carry that on, which I think as I was 24 by then. And I think at 24, you just assume that that will be fine to say that to somebody. And, you know, okay, they might get upset or offended, but they would definitely not take it to the level that this person did. So he held me in a hotel room for 2 days and he raped and beat me. And then 2 days later, he arranged for a stranger to me to throw sulfuric acid into my face. So this is like 17 years ago. There's no Me Too movement. There's no Time's Up movement. There's no feminist platforms. Instagram doesn't exist. There's no solidarity. There's questions like, well, why did you go with him in the first place? Why weren't you more careful? Why didn't you leave? You know, there's those kind of questions, like that's the culture. And I chose to go public with my story. I made a documentary about the very early stages of my recovery. And that's how I became known to people. You know, like some people might call me a celebrity now, but it's a weird title for me because I wasn't a famous model or TV presenter at all. You know, I was an aspiring one. And really how I became known to the public, it was a news story. You know, I was a victim of not domestic violence, a victim of gender-based violence, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, it's unfathomable. Firstly, you spent 2 months in hospital. You were placed in an induced coma intensive care before undergoing pioneering surgery and a very long rehabilitation. You had to wear a plastic pressure mask for 23 hours a day and be fed through a tube, and that the acid attack left you blinded in one eye. You've currently undergone more than 400 surgeries. I can't even, you know, people listening, maybe one, maybe two, but 10 even. But, do you know what I mean? Like 100? I mean, what, 400? And it's almost unfathomable amount that you've had to go through. So firstly, I'm sorry that you've ever had to go through this. And I'm sorry that it's times like that where you wish that you had had social media in a way for us all to rally round you, or to, I don't know, I can only imagine the loneliness that you might have felt. And I read something that you said in the aftermath, which was that when you first held the mirror up to your face afterwards, you felt as though your entire identity had gone, and that you could only communicate through writing. And you wrote a note to your parents that said, kill me. And it is just, for everyone right now, just absolutely heartbreaking. Do you remember much of those early days? And how did you even process how you were, I mean, it's the wrong words that I'm using, process how you were going to get through this? I mean, no one has a way of getting through this, but you did have a strong family. I can imagine that was such a blessing at this time. But what were those early days like on how to navigate this?
I don't really remember much of it anymore, to be honest. And I think, you know, whenever I mentor other burn survivors at my charity who are at the beginning, that's my advice to them, is like, know when to put it to bed and draw a line under talking about it. You know, don't relive it, don't rehash it. And that you can't get through these things alone. And that actually, it's not one thing that will work for you. It's a multidisciplinary approach. You know, sure, I had a great family, but I think also it's important to accept help from professionals. You know, like when you look at my story, I've written about it in books in detail, and it's not just one thing that's made me better. It's years and years of CBT therapy, EDMR, you know, you name it. I've tried every therapeutic method. And I think that one of the most important things up to present day is closure.
Yes.
And not going back on it. And actually, you find a lot of trauma sufferers have a lot of blanks. Like, it causes you memory loss. And when you look into the science of that, that's the body's way of surviving it, to actually disassociate, forget it, move forward. So, and I would say to anybody that looks at me and thinks, oh, how can I get to that stage of recovery? I still go to therapy. You know, I still have issues that aren't even the issues you'd think. They're probably much more relatable, normal issues. You know, when you touched on identity there, I know now from all the different women that I meet that actually we all experience different decades, different eras, where we completely lose identity, lose sight of who we are, and sometimes can feel that we'll never ever reclaim it. But we do, and we always reclaim it in really unthinkable ways and spaces. And sometimes it's hard to see that when you're in it, you know, and it's only by having others around us that have been through those things that makes us hold on to that hope that we'll get there somehow. And I think that's why it was important for me to go public, because there was a very, you know, tired narrative back then that as a woman, one of the most powerful currencies you can possess is beauty. And since I turned 40, I've then learned the second most powerful one is youth. And that actually, if you're not beautiful, if you're not young, you have less value if we're to listen to Andrew Tate and all these kinds of people. So, you know, I had all these ridiculous questions from, and it's not just men, I had these questions from women of like, do you hope to marry? What will you do now? And I remember thinking, oh my God, why are people saying this about me? Like, I'm still alive. I am still here. Yes, I'm not symmetrical. Yes, I look different. And yes, I have what's classed on paper as some disabilities. But I knew this wasn't the end of me. And I became very passionate about that, and that I shouldn't hide away and I should live authentically, because if other people were going to go through this or similar, they needed to be able to see some kind of not just survival or a quality of life, but something major. You know, you can be a CEO, you can feel sexy, you can be a trailblazer. Like, I don't know why the bar is so low if you no longer conform to society's standard of what is acceptable, which I will say has changed. It's definitely changed in 17 years and got better.
I'm taking myself back to when this all happened. And as you said, this was a different world that we were living in terms of how we looked at women. Women looking at other women, I would say as well, right? I mean, our prejudices were almost reflective of ourselves as well. We were all holding ourselves up to certain standards, all thinking it was about beauty or, you, as you said, now youth. And you said something in that period of time that the mind can be a desperately dark prison, but it can also be a tower of strength. And the strength of mind that you've had in talking about it, even doing the documentary, I would say. I mean, how quickly after it happened did you do this documentary? Because my question there is, what was that turning point? Was there a turning point that you said, I am now going to do something with this? I've read lots of things that you've written. I'm not special. Yes, something had happened to me, but I wouldn't let it define me. Was there a moment that you said, right, let's do this? Or someone that said, I think you can make this situation something that will help others?
I used to document my own recovery on a digital camera. Do you remember those?
Digital? Oh, I do.
Yeah. And mum used to help me do it. She used to photograph my injuries so we could document it for physio and scar management, and because progress was so slow, and making like a photographic journal and like plugging in the digital camera to the PC and downloading 76 images.
Oh, do you remember? And the little swirly thing when you're waiting for the pictures to upload.
Yeah.
My goodness.
And I used to make little storyboards and videos for like doctors and things like that, just because I hate not working. I was now unemployed. I was bored. Like, I don't like being unemployed. So I created like an unpaid workload for myself to create. I suppose you call it create content now. But then we didn't do that then, and there wasn't any platform.
Wasn't such a word called content either, was there?
No, and I didn't share myself online or anything back then. And then I was approached about this documentary. And as you know, in telly, you know, I filmed for like a year to make a 1 hour episode.
I'm very new to telly. I just love how you just said that. Bless you. Well, I'm two episodes in. Do you know what I mean? And in my entire life's telly's work.
A good insight, though.
Insight, though. It does take a lot of time.
Yeah. And I also, I felt sort of voiceless, and I wanted to have a voice where someone else wasn't sort of interpreting what I was saying, like it was me and I could trust people to translate it like that. And I felt like I had nothing to lose because I'd lost everything. And that's why, you know, as cliche and as American as it sounds about, you know, rock bottom being the best place, it is, because actually you think, well, what can I lose? What does it matter? And you don't really care as much what people think about you because they think so low of you. And that actually, you know, can be an advantage sometimes.
Because the bar is so low.
Well,
the only way is up.
Yeah, most people don't do things because of ego and fear, right? And rejection and what other people think of you. So if no one's contacting you anyway and you've got no job, no friends and your health's shot to pieces, it's quite a daring place to be. And I'd always been a sort of self-starter and always, I'd never really had a boss. I'd always been self-employed and worked for myself. So I was always used to taking risk and knowing that it would never get started unless it was me that started it. So I think I started to turn my recovery into a job and a formal role, because that's the only way I knew how to operate. I'd always thrived working, right? When I was at college, going to beauty college, they opened a 24-hour Tesco just outside the village. We were all so excited. We'd never have a 24-hour supermarket. And I was like, that means I can work at night and go to college in the day. So I got this job at Tesco, and then I got promoted at Tesco and made more money. Then I made a car washing business in the village. We didn't have a hose and stuff, but we went around with a bucket and then we'd refill it at each house. So I always found ways to do things. So this was just a bigger stumbling block than I'd ever had. But I felt like, well, surely there has to be a way to find purpose. And I'm a big believer in, and I know this is an easy thing to say if you're financially stable, not chasing money, because when you chase money, that becomes a bit of a trap and a circle. If you chase purpose and passion, then you monetize it afterwards in that order, and it becomes your living. And I know it's such a privilege to make a living out of something you're passionate about, and not everybody's in that position. But trust me, I've been a cleaner, I've been a car washer, I've worked in a supermarket. I definitely didn't always get, you know, paid for my passion.
Jumping in here to let you know that my brand new TV series, Be Your Own Boss, is now on ITV. One of my greatest honours in life has been shining a light on small businesses across the UK. It's truly been my life's work, and it's long been my dream to celebrate on a national stage what it really means to be a small business founder. Be Your Own Boss does exactly that. Each week, I'll receive two deliveries at home from small businesses in need of support. From what's inside, I'll make my first assessment before heading out to meet them in their workshops, studios, and kitchen tables to offer hands-on advice, encouragement, and a little bit of belief to help them grow. It's a show built on kindness, creativity, and courage, full of heart and practical inspiration. So if you've ever dreamed of starting your own business or just love seeing people chase their passions, tune in to Be Your Own Boss. Watch in the coming weeks on Sunday on ITV or catch up anytime with a cuppa on ITVX. And can I make an extra ask? Please, can you share it with friends, family and your followers to spread the word and support UK small businesses across the country? For now, though, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. You're a grafter. You really are. You're someone who puts in the work. I can tell when you decided to put that energy into your recovery, but also that your recovery became a job in a way. I mean, I've just never thought of it like that. But I mean, I had the greatest privilege speaking to Edith Edgar, a Holocaust survivor, for this podcast. And her words were, you're a human being who went through an experience, and it's not your identity. It's not who you are. It's what was done to you, and that you can refuse to be a victim.
Oh, that's so strong.
And incredibly powerful words. And I'd never forget Edith's words summing this up. And that defines what we almost think of the human spirit. And I'm wondering, do you think part of the human spirit is that moment, or the agency that we have, that moment where we can decide how we choose to define ourselves after something so life-changing?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, for me, I started to, because I'd always written and enjoyed writing and I'd enjoyed watching films and things, I started to think of my life a bit like a film, or at least a film script. And I thought, actually, you know, realistically, those two guys were only in the film for a few seconds, like only one scene, actually, really.
Oh my gosh, what a way of looking at it. How amazing.
Especially for films like 2 hours long.
Yeah.
You know,
they wouldn't.
Yeah, they wouldn't have even been cast as like big actors. They might have just been from like an extra agency, not been on a big fee. And if I'm like the main star, if I'm the lead, and then I'm also like producing and writing, I can just write the rest of the script. I can write the ending. I can actually edit things. And I started to see it a bit like that. And that, I suppose, helped me to take ownership back and realize, you know, factually, of course, there are things that are going to come into our life, uninvited, unwelcome, that we don't want to happen and we don't have control over. But we definitely always have control over the aftermath and how we deal with it. And it's really funny when we talk about identity, because I think misogyny assumes identity for women is how we look, right?
Mm.
And of course, there's a part of that. But, you know, talking to you about work, one of the hardest things for me that carried the deepest shame was when I couldn't work. And, you know, back then, being my only qualification was a beautician. So that's your hands, that's your eyes, and that's how you present. Well, those were all damaged. And I remember mum saying to me, they didn't charge me rent to move back home. They drove me to all my appointments. But my mum and dad didn't have a lot of money. And, you know, anyone that's been unwell will know hospital parking, prescriptions, overnight stays, like it bankrupts the family. And my mum said to me, we have to fill out paperwork. We have to get you onto benefits. And I remember sobbing over that, because
yeah,
it was like a pride. I was like, but I worked before I got my NI number. I worked from like 14, 15. We did tabletop sales at the end of the driveway. You know, I don't want to be on benefits. I feel like a failure. Like it was such an important thing to me. And again, when I work with anybody, I always talk to them about that reason to shower, that reason to get dressed, that reason to go out into the world. And I just think employment of any form, whether it's, you know, for salary or whether it's voluntary, whether it's working with charities, it's so important. It's so linked to your confidence and really your love for life and continuing living.
Oh, it's so eloquent. I mean, God, I'm paused here. Anyone that can't see me, I'm just leaning on my hand, just listening to you. And I just couldn't agree with you more. I mean, my career has been trying to help, I suppose, dreamers, people who have a dream and they want to do something. And, you know, people say, you know, oh, it's all about business, et cetera, et cetera. It is about business. I mean, I love business. I love the tool of business. It's actually about watching someone be the most them and be who they want to be in life and enabling them or helping them to be that. Because work that's worth doing is sort of an amazing, or just working and being happy in your work, and that what it gives you, there's so much more than financial. There is so much about your identity, about your passions, about self-discovery. You know, the 20 years I've been doing this and watching the same people find themselves over and over again through their business, because ultimately it means they're probably doing really interesting things, because it pushes you and it stretches you and you've got to overcome the roller coaster of everything. So you get to experience things that other people don't necessarily experience, in which then you grow yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where we sometimes, like you say, you know, there's so much more around work than just the classic work and a paycheck.
100%. And I always think, some people think it's like this place that you arrive at and then you're that person and you stay there forever. And I always think, with me, I do so many different jobs, so many different roles. And actually, when I was younger, I'll always remember particularly my dad saying, no, you find a job and you stay at it forever and you get a pension. And if you leave, it looks really bad on your CV. And they'll ask you, why did you leave? And they won't want to employ you. And maybe that was true in the 90s, right? But it's certainly not now. You know, they call us like the slashers, don't they? Where we've got all these job roles and we do all these different things. And, you know, I've been successful at some things, not at everything. I've failed at some things. But even now, I would still go, to a seminar, I would join a workshop and learn something new. I would volunteer. I would go and work for free to learn something. Like, it's not that I would say, right, I've done this and I'm staying here and this is what I'm good at. I'm not moving into other areas. I still like to move into unknown areas and learn things and progress. And I still feel like a success on one day and a failure on another. But I've really kind of learned that, you know, being younger, and it's another young, you know, message to your younger self. I'd look at other women and men and think, how do I get to where they are and be them? And I now realize, no, that's a transient place for everybody. And they want to be someone else or they want to be them again.
Yes.
And
yes.
There's no, like, you can't just stay in that club and then the work is done, you know?
Yeah, you can't. And what do you think? Because I mean, so many people are right now, whether you like it or not, are saying, God, she's so inspirational. And I'm sure a lot lots of people tell you that you are, but I'm wondering how you feel about that word, because of course people have created an image of you, but I'd love to know how this aligns with how you see yourself. And does it put pressure on you to maybe always have to be strong and positive, or appear to be?
It's a bit too wholesome for me. It's too much pressure, because it suggests perfection, which is quite an uncomfortable pedestal, really. And maybe doing a disservice to the people watching from afar, because who can sit on that pedestal forever and not fall off? And sometimes I think also what it can do is make you idolize people and platform people and say, well, they're special. They were born with this special thing. But you kind of touched on it earlier when you talked about the human spirit. It's within each and every one of us. But fortunately, most people don't have to tap into it, usually until sort of like 60s, 70s plus, when people start dying, they get diagnosis, terminal illness, you know, same of that thing of when do people start living, when they start dying, you know, and that's kind of a bit of a sad revelation, really. But when you've had a tragedy or a trauma at a young age, like I have, or some of the people at my foundation have, you have to tap into that human spirit. And what we all kind of learn in our experiences is it can get a bit frayed around the edges. It can get, you know, feeling like it's a little bit broken, but it's never completely destroyed. And you have these kind of epiphanies, you have these turning moments when you realize who you are and you start showing up for yourself and you realize, you know, I suppose what happened to me was that thing of you can only touch what you can see, right? You can only touch the surface. You can destroy and dismantle the surface, but you can touch somebody all over, but never own another, you know, spirit, soul. They're quite private things. And
very private.
Yeah, they remain very intact, actually. And I think, you know, for me, what I started to understand, like, growing up, I was born in 83, right? So I grew up in the like Special K diet era, slim fast, you know.
Slim fast.
Yeah. It wasn't actually, the pressure on us then wasn't about the face. It was all about body and it was all about weight. Mm. And it was like being thin was desirable. And actually it wasn't, people didn't inject their faces, change
their...
No,
they didn't. No, not at all. You didn't talk much about the face, actually.
No.
You're right.
Plastic surgery was something secretive that Hollywood people did.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was two Diet Cokes, one Slim Fast, and Sauvignon Blanc, please.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, with some silk cut. That was me.
It was literally that. And like, we didn't Photoshop. We didn't even document our faces online or critique. We didn't have trolling or anything like that. So the message for us was like, just be thin and then you're worthy and you're attractive. So confidence was still to be, you know, through deprivation and how you looked in that sense. So I think what happened to me is I then got forced into this place where I wasn't beautiful anymore. And I was so thin. I was 6 stone, come out of a coma, tube fed, couldn't swallow. Mm. So the irony of growing up in the 90s and, you know, oh, I'm a size 10. I wish I was an 8. Like, you know, how pathetic. Mm. Now I just want to swallow my own saliva. That would be great. I started to gain confidence from my ability, you know, my ability to assert myself, my ability to survive, my ability to really push through and carry on. And then what I understood about confidence and resilience is they're closely correlated, right? If you start to build up resilience, you have the confidence to know that whatever life throws at you, you're going to be okay. So now I know if I got divorced or if I went bankrupt or if I got unwell, I will always be able to reinvent, readapt, evolve, survive.
You would survive.
Yeah, I'm malleable. I'm not rigid, you know. So of course it would be sad for me, but it wouldn't be the end of me.
I think just to this point, your entire story is, and I'm not saying this is where it started, because as you said, this has been an evolution of you, is you're not a victim, and that you are one of a survivor, and that you shared your journey so openly, especially through your documentary, Katie, My Beautiful Face. And I know that before that, you'd spoken of feeling quite isolated. And so, yes, you made it news, but you felt isolated and you faced judgment and unbelievable cruelty from strangers. What was it like to take a step into that public eye and tell your story on your own terms? Did you feel strong enough then, or was it a leap of faith?
I think it was a bit of both. And actually, this is why I'll never moan about social media or trolling, because like you, I have an incredible community around me as a result of putting myself out there. And I saw the absolute best in the British public from all walks of life. People were so supportive to me in so many different ways. So much so that the public inspired me to set up my charity, because people were putting this is how long ago it was. People were putting checks through my mum and dad's door, because we lived in a small village and they recognised the exterior of the house on the documentary. £10, £5, £20, £10 notes. And my mum and dad, very strict, they were like, you're on disability benefit. That's fraud if you keep that money. So I was like, okay.
Mum and dad, please.
shop me to the benefits people. So we set up a bank account with charitable status. And the original plan was, well, we'll just make like a trust. And then if anyone gets badly burnt and they want to access the treatment that I accessed that was abroad, we can just give them a grant for them to go and access that treatment. But because the public support didn't stop, that grew and grew and formalised to a board and trustees. And fast forward 15 years on, we have our own rehab centre in the UK, like the one I visited abroad. So, you know, I think there's loads of stuff going on in the world now that if you sat on X or Twitter or whatever you call it and you scroll, you feel so bad about the world. And I really want to encourage everyone to always look for the helpers, because they are always there. And my experience just showed me, on the whole, we are such decent, kind, loving people. And it wasn't just everyone coming up to me, embracing me physically and telling me. It was the nod in a supermarket. It was just the exchanging a stare with each other, a kind one, where I knew that woman was a survivor too. Yes, it wasn't visual, but I knew she'd been through something. And sadly, the amount of people that have either been abused in some kind of way or just never felt enough is such a high volume.
Yeah.
So many people have been made to not feel good enough in life. And I've just felt those exchanges, those glances, and that energy transfer with so many people. But it was very healing. It restored my faith in society that people are good. And when we come together collectively, we can do amazing things.
You said it sounds so cheesy to say, but it really was an inside out makeover. You see the confidence come across me and on screen. And it feels like sharing your story, like you said, was this turning point. I mean, I do believe in always moving forward, actually, just one step in front of the other, never looking back in a way. Now and again, you have to look back, but actually it feels like you are a woman in the heart. You know, Katie hasn't changed from the Tom girl that you were, you know, back then, and wanting, you were curious and in a hurry, and you had 3.5 million viewers who saw your journey. It was BAFTA nominated. I mean, this isn't just a documentary, you know, this is phenomenal. And as you said, you formed the Katie Piper Foundation, helping survivors of burns and scars. When you look at your life, you couldn't make up more of a worthwhile existence for yourself than doing what you do with your heart, your soul. But yet it's taken you to have to go through so much to be here. I mean, how do you quantify what you went through to, but then to be where you are today?
I think we all go through stuff to get to who we are today. And I think that's one of the ways we're shortchanging younger people is we show them the highlights reel. We show them the success. We show them the end point. And I suppose what my journey is it's visual. So people can see the suffering, they can see the pain, they can see the transition. But make no mistake, that's behind everyone's story. Anyone that writes an autobiography, or you go and sit with an older person with life experience and have a cup of tea and you talk to them about it, there's always some element of loss, trauma, tragedy, and more commonly behind successful people, because that often really, really drives them. So I don't think I'm unique in that way. I think a lot of this is about you've got to take ownership and you've got to reclaim your power. So our deepest insecurities can only be weaponized against us if we let them. So when you talk about people that say, don't want to wear a bikini on the beach because they've got cellulite, right? Even if it's a bit emperor's clothing and you're not really walking the walk yet, you're just trying to talk the talk, right? You go on that beach and you're like, I don't give a shit what you all think about me and my cellulite. Maybe for a few seconds, someone's like, oh, look, she's got cellulite. And the other person's like, oh, yeah, should we go get a pint? It's done, isn't it? Like, you can't,
that's it.
You can't humiliate me or embarrass me about something that I am taking back the ownership of. Like, people can troll me online and I'm like, I know what I look like. Like, my job is not to be beautiful for you. Like, I don't need you to fancy me to come online and sell my book. Like, that doesn't work for me. And then you sort of disarm the perpetrator. Like, they no longer hold the cards. They don't have that power. And that in itself is quite attractive and sexy. So then you go full circle of making yourself super attractive, you know, that you have to be like, you have to be the source. You can't let the other person be the source and the key holder to your happiness, your confidence, because then they just like rule you. And that's so exhausting.
Each week at this point, I hand over to our partners at Royal Mail. And for any founders listening, I wanted to make sure you knew about their full range of service points that will make your busy life even easier. Royal Mail have over 130,000 drop-off service points for your parcels. This includes Royal Mail shops. Most shops are open 7 days a week until late and are an easy and convenient way to collect, send and return parcels. Royal Mail also have parcel lockers available, an easy and convenient way to drop off your parcels. If you have a smaller parcel, you can also use your local postbox. So there's a drop-off point just around the corner. The Royal Mail app let you scan your parcel's barcode to generate a proof of posting when you drop them off. So why not buy your postage online and choose the drop-off option that suits you and let Royal Mail do the rest. Now back to our conversation of inspiration. I think what's obvious here is how much work you've done on yourself, how much work you've obviously done with others. I know that you've said it can be people that you help. It could be as extreme as being suicidal or having post-traumatic stress, anxiety, depression, low-level self-esteem, helping people get back to work, helping people feel self-worth, all of these sorts of things. So you must have absorbed so much insight into the human nature, recovery, how one comes out of something like this. And now you help so many people with your foundation, but through your books and your brilliant podcast, Extraordinary People, where you share stories of utter resilience, either through campaigning or inspirational speaking, TV, radio, you're a columnist. I mean, there's literally something, you know, you do it all. And I remember speaking to Sophie Morgan for this podcast, and she was paralyzed in a car crash.
Yeah, her book's brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant. When she was 18, and she spoke about the preconceptions that she faced, and that there's still a lot of stigma in society around visible injuries and whether there's disability or scarring, and what more needs to be done. So here you are as a highly successful person. Do we need more visibility in our culture? And are the people that your foundation works with seeing and feeling the shift that you didn't have back when it happened?
Yeah, it's definitely a different climate. I've worked with Sophie a lot, and she's an incredible person. She does a lot of campaigning herself. And, you know, I could never compare my life to hers because she's a wheelchair user. She's paralyzed. It's a very different experience that she had to me. I think if we look at media, you know, absolutely. When I was burnt 17 years ago, there were no models or presenters with facial disfigurement.
No.
There just weren't. You know, we saw facial disfigurement in Simon Weston, our military heroes. They were heroes from the war and at school people to fundraise for, really.
Yes,
you know,
yes, you're right.
They weren't like selling us product, or they weren't aspirational. They weren't role models in that sense. So definitely climate has changed. But yeah, it's still very difficult where, you know, for me, I would say, like, without sounding arrogant, I'm very accomplished in my chosen profession now. I've made hours and hours of television in America, in the UK, on all different subjects, from, you know, news, entertainment, broadcast, documentaries, radio. I've set up businesses. But still people will want to talk to me about an acid attack. You know, that was 17 years ago for me. It's not the most dominant thing in my life, but it is hard for people. But I think that's changing, and I think that's definitely a positive thing. But it can be really difficult. But, you know, people's lives are difficult for all different reasons. And I don't think it's about, like, moping over the cards that you get dealt. It's definitely about, like, okay, this is my hand. So how am I going to play it, right? Mm-hmm. I always find opportunity. I always arrive at excitement with every situation that I'm in and try to sort of turn that around in that way. So, you know, sure, I know that I look different. I know that I'll face discrimination. But if I hadn't been burnt, I'm sure there would have been other barriers in my life that I wouldn't have foreseen. I think what was interesting for me was entering this new era, this new decade in my 40s, because I'd done so much work with my foundation, but outside of my foundation, through my books and programs around beauty, right? And here I was about to turn 40, which I was quite excited about, you know, more life living. That's great. You know, there's some incredible women that have documented their battles with cancer over the last few years who have died in their 40s. You know, like, how dare we commiserate life? I think that's crazy. And again, it's eternalized misogyny, and it comes not just from men. Like, I was getting a lot of female journalists being like, do you mind if we print your real age? Are you happy to talk about this big birthday you've got coming up? You know, when I was 39, about to turn 40. And I just thought, God, you would have sat across me 10 years ago and interviewed me about surviving and how great that is. Why are we treating women like this? You know, if life expectancy is 80, I'm only 50% through at 40. It's nothing.
Yes.
But and I think the message has changed a little bit with aging, where we have older women on telly now and we have older women selling us product. But the message is, you can be 50 and tell us you're 50, but please don't look 50.
I'm finding this all quite difficult, because I was thinking about, I'm a few years off 50 and I'm super excited about being 50. And actually, 40s have been the best ever.
I love my 40s.
I've heard 60s are amazing too, by the way. So I'm sort of like, I need to, like, calm down, Holly, and just, like, do not do the two decades in a heartbeat. But I'm finding it interesting as we move forward. I watched Sting at the Apollo the other day, and it was incredible. He's 74, and he is amazing. And I turned around to my husband. He just turned 65. And he's anyone on this podcast knows I do talk to him. He doesn't listen to this podcast, so it's slightly, he's like a half glass full kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I was trying to almost go, but do you understand he's 74?
Uh-huh.
And it's like, yeah, well, he's a pop star and things like that. And I said, but listen, we're living in an age, in an era where we look at the Sex and the City girls versus the golden women. Was it called Golden Girls? And they were the same age. And we look at the A-list celebrities going on the red carpet, and I'm literally, I can't cope that they are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and how amazing.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's something I feel very proud of living in this era, where 40 is the, you know, 60 is the new 40 and all that sort of thing. But it still falls down to the fact that everyone looks really good.
Yeah, so the message is still, be beautiful. Like, that's your look young, be beautiful, that's your worth. And I think that's what we need to change. And I think this is what inspired me to write my latest book, Still Beautiful.
Tell me about this. I was literally about to talk about this. So tell me about this book.
So I really dissect chapter by chapter all around. Like, if you've ever felt not good enough, if you've ever felt lacking in some way, it's not your fault. Mm. And actually look at who made you feel like that. And actually the person that made you feel like that is often selling you the solution as well. So it's just to kind of trap us, because if we're no longer, if we've all got high levels of self-esteem and confidence, we're not going to constantly buy disposable fashion. We're not going to constantly buy overpriced lotions and potions. And probably the economy would collapse about insecure women, right? It's not good for the economy if we're all okay. They need to keep us at this level where we just have to keep consuming all the time. And I've got two young daughters, and I just wanted to write the truth and how I've found this out the hard way. And, you know, we tell younger girls in particular, like your 20s or your heyday, no, I was eating gone-off food, living in a rented bedroom. I had to keep my food and shampoo all in my bedroom because everyone was stealing it in the shared bathroom and shared kitchen. Like, they were not, that was not my heyday. Like, my 20s was a time for mistakes, experimenting, and being skint. And actually, my 40s are the most financially secure I have ever been. They're the most stable I've ever felt. I'm able to say no without feeling rude. I'm able to be confident. I couldn't do any of that, not even in my 30s. So I'm assuming that 50s must be better, and then 60s must be an even more improvement, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that however much older you get, I feel personally, you still fall into the trap. You know, I talk about being the most me I've ever been. Similarly, I'm buying more creams than I've ever bought in my life. More gadgets. I mean, I love this stuff, by the way, as well, I have to say. So I bought all the gadgets and everything like that. And I know you've written about confidence as well. You know, I feel the most confidence I've ever felt. Yeah, just still with the pressure I must have had when I was 20, you know, and I sort of can't shift it, I suppose. I think many women can't shift it. You know, it's, I can read the newspapers this weekend and it is continuously what tweakments, what is the latest laser, what is the latest things. And I find myself absolutely fascinated in all of it, don't get me wrong. But I still have that as my sort of something that's high up in what I've got to succeed in.
It's very difficult. And I think because it's becoming noisier and noisier around us, and because we can make all these comparisons and we can see what other people are doing or not doing, there's almost like that added pressure. But I think we just have to stay grounded and go back to who are we? Why are we doing what we're doing? And understanding that things are people's highlights and how they want to portray themselves are not always the truth. And I think, you know, although that can be challenging, I think that's why I became so passionate about this message in the book, and that identity is more important than ever, because we have to have our anchor and we have to be able to go back to that, and that's our safe place.
And is that what you tell your children? How do you deal, like, when before we went on the podcast, we were talking about, you know, their consumption of what their, you know, the comparisons, the reels, the hours of, I mean, seriously, like, hours of that stuff that they're looking at, and every beauty product available, and every, do you know what I mean? Like, everything available. I didn't even know what Botox was. Until I was 30 years old. I didn't even know what it was. And so now they have this beauty menu, so to speak. They just have all the pictures, all the videos continuously. How do you get them excited about, or lots of people right now dealing with teenage daughters, or how do we get them excited? Because what you champion is resilience, confidence, inner strength, purpose, everything that's inside, not on the outside.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. And, you know, I have to say, I have nothing against people who, you know, I have Botox myself. I don't think any differently of someone that chooses to have elective cosmetic surgery, because I don't want to contribute to policing other women's appearance, telling them how they should and shouldn't look, and what, you know, the good women and the bad women that do this. Like, a woman can look however she wants, so long as it's her choice. And so long as other people haven't made her feel that she has to look like that. You know, that's in informed choice and consent. And if you're a sound mind and body and mental health, then that's okay. And we should all tolerate that. And we shouldn't be telling other women they're weaker for adjusting this or changing that. Mm. But yeah, with my own children, I have to talk to them about who are you? What is going to be your legacy? What do you contribute? Sure, if you go and have a nose job and change the shape of your nose, like what is that contributing to your life? Like, how does that change? And look at what's happened to me and look at what happens in aging. All of this is momentary. All of this is fragile. It's surface. It's transient. Like, we never own this. We fool ourselves that we do. We're just borrowing it. And as we go, everyone else's changes are very gradual and slow. Mine were in seconds overnight. It's a very unique experience. But, you know, I talk to my daughter about what teams is she on? What sport is she on? What books is she reading? What does she know about what's happening in the world? Who is she? If she has to write an elevator pitch, a bio, a synopsis, you know, like what's going on there? And it's not fair to other mums and dads to be like, well, my kids aren't going to do this or that. Because the truth is, once you get to puberty and adolescence, it's not like that. You can have all these ideas about what your kids are going to do or not do and how they're going to feel. And it's very difficult to navigate that. You know, I'm not popular right now because my eldest wants a phone. And I've signed that phone smart-free childhood pact where you say you won't give your child a smartphone at least until age 14. So she's 11 and furious. But, you know, unfortunately, that's what's right for us and our family at the moment. So I'm having to do a lot of, you know, I don't care what so-and-so's mum and dad are doing or family are doing.
Oh, I know, that conversation.
Yeah.
And I used to get, but you should care.
Yeah. And look, I'm not sat here saying I'm the best mum and I've got all answers.
I mean, I'm just like, I'm good for you. For you for doing that. I'm wondering when you know, you're 42 and you're so young, basically. I mean, you've got so much to do and I'm sure you're a woman in a hurry and you have, I can only imagine what your list is like. Do you feel, I don't know, I look at that question, I think about myself, I sort of feel maybe there was like my pre-40s and my after 40s. I don't know, like, I feel like 40 is quite a pivotal age.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you have a before and after? Is your before the attack and after the attack? Or is actually, talk to me about how you're looking at time and sort of what you then think about your second act, so to speak.
I think actually, I know some people talk about second act being like after menopause, and this like this clear sort of before and after. But I think I've had so many transitions in my life that aren't just the obvious ones, you know? And I think there's no doubt life changes when you become a mum. And it's weird because it's not at the car seat carrying age because you just need to like feed them and keep them alive. Like it's actually a few years on where, you know, it's really hard to continue your professional life. Like it is, whatever we say about having it all, it is so hard to either maintain or improve a career once you have children. And you will spend all your life either feeling like you're failing at work or you're a shit mum. Like you'll just feel one of those, never together. But separately at either time, and that will be forever. So long as you continue to work and so long as you continue to mother, that will just be forever. And that's the way it is. And I'm often feeling bad because the school give us 1 week's notice for the carol concert and the non-uniform day and all the things that I can't go to. And then my kids get cross. And then I will turn down these big jobs to go and see my kid in the play. Turns out she's only a sheep with no words. And then I see all my colleagues and peers doing these big shiny things in like the world of telly, and I'm like, I should have gone, should have done it. Now I've got professional
but I
jealousy.
saw the sheep,
it's fine. And that just happens all the time, you know. And then just different, I'll have so many before and afters that are more subtle where I'll look back and think, I'm not that person anymore. And that might be still in the same year, that might have been spring to like now in the fall, where I'm like, I'm not her anymore, I don't feel like that anymore, I've let go of that, I'm not going to be like that, you know. And you don't tell anyone about those things. You just...
No, you don't.
No,
you don't. They're very,
shift.
Very personal, aren't they? There's just this shift. But if you had to, we use the analogy of standing coming off the dance floor and taking the back stairs up to the balcony. And then we stand on the balcony and we look down on the dance floor and we look at things. And it helps us when we build the business because we're normally on the dance floor panicking and trying to do all the little bits. And actually, if you stand on the balcony, it's you get a better picture of things. When you're married to Richard, man, you called the love of your life and you're about to come up 10 years because you're going away, just reminding.
Yeah.
You're going away again.
I need to pack.
You got to pack two beautiful daughters. And do you have a sense when you're standing on that balcony now, do you have a sense of peace in life in yourself now?
That's a really tough question because I'm not very good, like I can't meditate or anything like that, right? Mm. I find like stillness and movement. And I almost fear a bit of peace where I thrive in chaos and emergency because unfortunately that has been all of my younger years.
Yeah.
So I almost operate better like that. And I'm that person when you go on holiday, it takes me 3 days to relax. Then by day four, I'm relaxed. Then day seven, we're all going home and I'm stressed again. and unfortunately, that's me. And actually, there's some negatives to that, but that's contributed to some real successes in my life as well.
Yeah.
So I never really like rest on my laurels. I never really bask in anything. And I'm aware that's not something I should be showing off about, you know, but mate, that's one of my faults a little bit.
Do you call yourself an entrepreneur?
Not really, no.
But I would say after interviewing, you know, I think I'm on 230 now. I would say if the events had not unfolded as they had, you know, you literally are the sort of classic. I was selling this. I realized I could get a night job and then I could have a day job. And then, and then I was selling this. And then I saw an opportunity here. And then I couldn't wait to get out of home. And then I was done. Do you just mean like you literally sound, I can't meditate. I'm ready. I'm on the go. I need to get in. I can't not work. All these sorts of things. It's an incredibly entrepreneurial DNA set you've got there.
Yeah, maybe. I never thought about it like that. And I suppose when I first set up my charity, I was excited of like, I know how we can fundraise. I know how we can create this.
Yeah.
I know how we can make space. I know how we can do workshops. I know we can create networks. And I did find it exciting, but maybe I've never had the confidence to think of myself like that commercially.
I would say that you are. Say that you really, really are. I can't actually, my whole brain is like going because I'm like going, I think that you are just an entrepreneur. And actually, maybe that's your next a decade coming up. I think you were born it, maybe.
But I think what happened to me, and actually now this has changed and it's positive, and I gave a speech last week. I got given one of those honorary doctorates.
I saw, by the way. I saw. I was so happy for you.
Well, I felt like so embarrassed because obviously it's a prestigious uni and they're amazing people that have studied, you know, PhDs and like, they've given up their life to study, right? And I felt like, oh my goodness, I didn't even get A-levels. And I've always felt like this kind of imposter syndrome and not good enough that I didn't do higher education. And that's what's always held me back and been a big regret of mine. But I think the world is changing now where if my kids didn't want to go to uni, I would be cool with that so long as they're working, right?
Yeah.
And so long as they're doing an apprenticeship or they're doing something that means they're contributing to society. And when I gave my speech at that doctorate, I said, these weren't my classrooms. I didn't learn in walls that you're learning in, but I did go and pick up my education in X, Y, and Z places. And the outcome has been positive. Yeah. And I think I'm only now free of those chains and that shame.
Well, hello. Of course you should be. Look who I'm speaking to.
But I feel like now I would employ somebody absolutely without a degree. Like that doesn't bother me at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Completely. I don't have a degree. I mean,
do you not? I would assume that you do.
No, I got, listen, I mean, they're so bored at hearing this, but I haven't told it for a while, but I got two A's in A level, and I thought I got a D in business studies. And my mum found the piece of paper a few years ago. I got an E in business studies, A levels.
That surprises me so much. Okay.
But I love that surprises you because that means that maybe I'm faking it enough that. And then I didn't go to university, so I have no degree myself. And
wow.
I would absolutely. I think that you cannot teach passion, and you cannot teach hard work and enthusiasm. Right? I think you can mold people, But what I'm trying to say is turning up with all of that and having a lust for life and learning and to move forward, I would employ any day over pieces of paper.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that we've got to, at Holly & Co, we have so many, I've only got a small team, but a proportion of them that are school leavers, because I do believe in this completely and utterly.
Yeah.
And I think that we should, moving forward, be trying to almost employ those who haven't taken the conventional path, because maybe they're quite interesting for not taking the conventional path.
That's definitely one of the positive things now, isn't it, about how anyone can work from home, build stuff online, they can platform themselves, and now people that were so talented who we wouldn't hear about or see can do that. And
we see them. I could talk to you for hours. I have already kept you for too long. Katie, we're coming to the end of this podcast. I was wondering if I could ask you, because I ask every single person, that being on this journey as an entrepreneur, as a founder, as someone who we're all so influenced by, what has been, you say, one of your lowest moments on your journey? If you don't mind me asking that as a potentially an insensitive question, but you might not want to give that as an answer, but I just wanted to ask you, as I've asked everybody.
I suppose like my low is almost sort of intrinsically linked with my high, because it was the feeling that I had nothing left. And I think, again, people, any big loss, whether it's bereavement, divorce, failure in business and bankruptcy, you feel like everything's gone and you've lost everything, it's been taken from you. But I now understand that you never really had those things anyway. And really the one thing we always need is our foundation, is our health, right? Mm-hmm. And actually that's the worst thing to be taken from us, because if it's taken in an extreme way, then we're actually dead. So that's it. It's over. So long as you're still alive, you've got everything, right? And I didn't understand that for quite a few years. And then as it went full circle, I realised, oh, they're just all things that pass in and out of our lives. Just like we don't own our children. Like, our job is to support them in those years and let them go out into the world. And if they want to come back to us as mates later on, that's their choice. And then maybe we did do a good job. So the thought that I'd lost everything, and how on earth was it going to come back to me when it was such a permanent thing that I couldn't change? And then I suppose the high was the liberation of, like, I never needed all that stuff. I don't need to be all those things that other people need me to be those things. I don't need me to be those things, right? I mean, I even had it as recent as last week. I was on holiday and I'd posted an ad before I'd gone on holiday. It was advertising milk, right? And I was doing like a this and that about how do you take your tea, your coffee. And all these trolls started commenting about my appearance, you know, just slating me, comparing me to these characters in a sci-fi film, saying I was ugly. And I was on the beach and I was looking at this and I was thinking, that wasn't the brand's, like, there wasn't guidelines from the milk brand that I had to be beautiful to sell milk. Everyone drinks milk, okay? Most people take milk in their tea or coffee, right? I don't need Jeff from Shropshire to fancy me for me to have milk in my tea. And I kind of replied to just one comment and I was like, it's okay. My objective was not to be attractive to you. Your discomfort is not my burden. And obviously that made the guy absolutely furious. Like I kind of disarmed him, right? I took away his power. And that was almost a high for me, that it's like, I don't need Jeff in Shropshire to fancy me. I don't need him to think that I'm attractive. And I don't feel any less or worse for him telling me I'm ugly. It's like, I know. Yeah. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything in my life. And I suppose, like, the younger me, it would have changed everything. You know, I would have felt so bad that Jeff didn't think I was gorgeous.
But I don't find... Firstly, I want Jeff to choke on his milk, just so you know. I really, really hope that he's lactose intolerant and that he comes out in complete hives, you know. But don't you find it shocking? Not shocking, but, like, so boring and so... How after 17 years, how can anyone be saying any of this? Doesn't the world dry out? I mean...
Yeah, but this is what I wrote about in my new book, is that It's still a deep belief for a lot of men and women that the way to injure or wound a woman is by commenting on her face or body. And there's a deep belief that that is the most shameful, insulting thing to lack in those areas. And it's so much internalized misogyny. And for me, it was so liberating. I looked around at everyone on the beach and I thought, my God, I wonder how many other women are free like me. Because I really don't have to live like that. Like being disfigured at such a young age meant that I clocked out of that race and that competition.
And I bet you are one of a few.
Yeah, definitely. So imagine like the low of being disfigured in your 20s, right? Versus the high of in your 40s being like, I stopped competing ages ago. Yeah. It's okay. I don't need to be the most beautiful. And everyone was in their bikinis. And I thought, how many women here would have not been able to come on the beach today because of someone like Jeff? Like if they got that message, you know? So it's very liberating and freeing, you know?
Gosh, I still hope he is lactose intolerant. I really, really do. Even though I can't even say lactose. I hope I'm saying it right. My dyslexia gets the better of me. And then I start doubting the fact that I can even speak English.
Who cares? We don't need to say it. It was a feeling and it was a good feeling.
It was a feeling. And let's hope. Yeah. Katie, you have just been just tonic today. Thank you for sharing everything. It's that time in the podcast where I'm going to hand over to yourself to read a letter to your younger self. And I don't know what you're going to say, but I just have to say on behalf of myself and everyone listening, thank you for sharing a part of your soul with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Okay. Katie, sit down, listen, concentrate. First things first, stop overplucking your eyebrows because you'll thank me later. Now, you won't believe this yet, but one day you'll learn that the things that make you different aren't flaws to be fixed. They're gifts that shape your strength. I know right now that you're trying so hard to fit in to a version of beauty that everyone else seems to understand except you. But one day you'll find that beauty isn't about perfection. It's about authenticity, kindness, and deep courage. There will be moments ahead that feel impossible. Times when you'll question who you are or whether you'll ever feel like you again. But you will. In fact, you'll become more yourself than you ever dreamed possible. You'll discover that resilience isn't about being unbreakable. It's about rebuilding again and again. But with more compassion each time, self-compassion will be key. You'll also learn that laughter is a kind of medicine, that true friends show up when the cameras are off, and that healing doesn't happen in a straight line. And when life slows down, don't rush to get back to normal. The new version of you will be deeper, she'll be stronger, and she'll be more beautiful than what was before. You'll write books that you never expected to write. You'll meet people who inspire you beyond words and even will end up showing your more imperfect self with pride. Yes, really. You'll find your voice and you'll use it to lift others, and you'll realize that sharing your story helps others find the courage to share theirs too. So please breathe. You don't have to have it all figured out yet. Keep your heart open, your sense of humor close, and your faith strong, because the road ahead, my darling, will not always be easy, but it will be extraordinary because you will make it so. With love and gratitude, old woman Katie.
Gosh, you're just, watch out, world. Just watch out, world. You're truly beautiful.
Ah, thank you.
That's what I'd say. You really are. You inspire and you give us strength. And I think you've reminded us all on what it is to be, I don't know, I'm talking to myself as you were talking about, we've got to just jump off this bandwagon that we're on, or jump off the pressures that we're feeling. And that your story and the way you have been so articulate in communicating that with us today, we've all got to check ourselves.
Yeah.
We've got to check ourselves and understand our worth and our value. And you really embody that, by the way. And I can't imagine what you're going to be up to in the next couple of decades, your best decades. But I've got to say, I'm here for it. I'm here to help in any way I can. And just thank you for being glorious.
Oh, thank you. It's been such a pleasure. And I just want to leave everybody with the thought that it's actually really exciting because we're all so capable. You know, this isn't just about me and my story, and we should never let anyone dictate to us what we need to be, look like, or what we need to show up and be us, because it's all within and we own it. We've got it. It's untouchable. So you've got the tools. You just need to believe it and tap into it. And I find that really exciting for all of us.
Absolutely. Gosh, you've left us with tonic, absolute tonic. So much milk in our tea as well. Thank
right.
you.
Yeah. Listen, it's been so great to talk
Bless
to you.
You.
Thank you for having me.
So much. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.